Hello, everyone. My name is Mickey. I'm one of the soft tissue surgeons here at Paragon Veterinary Referrals in Wakefield, and I'm joined by our surgery resident, Dan Kenny.
Hi.
And we're going to talk, have a chat today about ear surgery in dogs and cats. And I think the title is something along the lines of ear surgery, is it always TICA and VBO? So we don't recognise that ear surgery sort of the various procedures seem to be always have associated with an acronym. But I think sometimes there's a bit of confusion over when to use what procedure and the benefit, pros and cons. And I think that's something we're going to sort of have a chat about, essentially what the procedures mean and why we do what we do. So to start us off, I think Dan's got some questions.
I have got some questions.
Excellent. It's a relief.
So we'll start with a fairly broad one. In our hospital here, what are the general indications for ear surgery in dogs? Why do we tend to see patients coming here for ear surgery?
So it's a really good question, because one of the fundamentals of sort of decision making in ear surgery or treatment of management of chronic ear disease is related to the reasons behind the problem and the reason and the differences, particularly between dogs and cats, in terms of the way they get ear disease and the problems that we see. So the question is sort of what are the common indications for ear surgery in dogs? And I suppose the most common, certainly in my practice, is chronic otitis externa, typically related to generalized skin disease or as a symptom of skin disease. So dogs that have chronic ear disease, we recognize that they have significant changes in their external ear canal, and with time they can develop secondary otitis media as well. And I think a lot of the dogs will come to see our dermatologist initially, but when they feel that they can no longer salvage the ear, then typically those dogs come passed over to surgery for surgery. And by the time they get to me, most of the time with end stage ear disease, we're looking at doing a total ear canal ablation. So we see with a lateral bulbar osteotomy. So we see a population of animals where essentially we can no longer salvage the ear, and those animals are typically in a lot of discomfort. And by doing a salvage procedure, a total ear canal ablation, we can hopefully significantly improve their quality of life.
What kind of clinical signs do you tend to associate with that? So if you were in practice, what do you think Sean would be looking for to say, hey, this is like not manageable anymore? So criteria indicate maybe this dog needs surgery rather than...
I think there's not necessarily one rule fits all here. Certainly when the ears become chronically very changed, then that essentially means that it becomes much harder to medicate. So if you've got significant narrowing of the ear canal, significant proliferation around of tissue, then you know it becomes progressively harder to manage the ear topically. So sometimes you get the dogs that with the very sort of chronic end stage changes, but we also see dogs where have got very more acute disease, where essentially they have marked inflammation and erosion of their ear canal, and sometimes that can be associated with like a Pseudomonas infection. So I think sometimes, you know, particularly if you get an animal with a multi-drug resistant infection, then it becomes more challenging to manage. And of course, when it progresses to otitis media as well, then again that represents an even, you know, another challenge to topical management. And at that point, when you know you've got documented multi-drug resistant infection and otitis media, then often surgery becomes more likely. I think the other thing to remember is that, you know, clearly this is decisions are made with owners. Some owners are very keen to avoid surgery, so perhaps medical management becomes, you know, is their priority, whereas the other owners, you know, understandably become very find medicating their dogs very challenging, and actually a surgical solution sometimes becomes very appealing. So there's not necessarily a right or wrong. You know, some owners would have quite a low threshold for wanting to go for surgery. Others, you know, really keen to avoid it. What's been your experience, Dan?
Yeah, exactly the same as that, really. I guess as you touched on, having chronic end-stage changes of thickening of the ear canals, sometimes they'll get mineralization in their ear canals, really kind of inhibits what you can do with medical management. But as you mentioned, owners are kind of the main deciding factor in this process, and some of them are very pro-surgery and find it very difficult to medicate their dogs' ears. So I guess behavior of the dog and tolerance of the dog to ear medications is also a factor, because if they're finding that they're stressing their dog out multiple times a day to try and manage its ear disease, and they find that stressful themselves and the dog's finding that stressful, then those people might be more prone to opting for surgery earlier than perhaps a dog that was really tolerant of having ear medications as well would be. But yeah, very similar. It tends to be in those patients that have got really thick and horrible ears and are pretty sad with it all. So I guess you'd generally recommend TEGA surgery for those patients with chronic otitis externa. There are other surgery options available for patients to remove parts of external ear canal. Would you mind just going through those options and potentially why you might want to do them, why you might not want to do them?
Okay, all right. Yeah. So I suppose, I mean, the classic is the lateral resection, or sometimes referred to as the ZET procedure, which does exactly what it says in the tin. On the tin, you remove the lateral wall of the external ear canal. I think lateral resections are kind of a procedure which maybe isn't necessarily that useful, but there are certain indications for it, and it can be very useful in certain circumstances. However, if it's used in the wrong circumstances, then it sort of has a high complication rate or failure rate, and therefore people, you know, don't necessarily think it's much use. So essentially, the two main reasons to do a lateral wall. But the main reason to do a lateral wall resection is, by removing the lateral wall, you improve ventilation and drainage of the external ear canal, particularly obviously the horizontal canal. And hopefully that should enable improved medication and an improved environment for dogs with otitis externa. Now, the problem is that if the animals already have significant changes in their horizontal canal, then actually by moving the lateral wall of the vertical canal, you may not actually improve the situation that much. And if for those animals with otitis media, then it probably won't necessarily be particularly beneficial. So in terms of managing otitis in dogs, lateral resection is indicated quite early in the course of the disease, before the animals have really chronic changes, in order to try and improve treatment so that actually they don't progress to have chronic otitis externa. So it's quite a big deal, I guess, to think, oh, this dog's had one or two episodes of otitis externa, let's go ahead and do a lateral resection. So it tends to be left until things are more serious, and then you've kind of maybe missed that window opportunity to really gain the benefit from that procedure. The other thing it may be beneficial for is if you've got a mass lesion on the lateral wall, because obviously you can then, you know, particularly benign lesion, but also even a malignant lesion, because you, depending on size and the location, you may be able to perform a lateral wall resection and actually remove the mass with a sensible margin. So that's probably the indications for lateral wall resection. It's not something we do very commonly at all. Vertical canal ablation, probably even fewer indications. The main indication would be for similar reasons to the lateral wall section, but the main reasons for vertical canal ablation would be a tumour or mass lesion of the vertical canal. And by removing the entire vertical canal, hopefully we can remove that mass with a margin and provide a cure for that tumour. So that would be the main reason. Again, if you're doing it for otitis, then if you've got significant changes in the vertical canal, the horizontal canal, then it may not be particularly helpful.
Cool, thank you, that's really helpful. We talk about TEGA, but we also talk about lateral osteotomy as well. Can you do one without the other?
Well, no, not really, no. You should know. But I think, I suppose probably for our audience, it might be worth just recapping what a total ear canal ablation is. So do you want to just outline that, and then I can address your question?
Yeah, sure. So with total ear canal ablations, it kind of does what it says on the tin. We are removing or ablating the external ear canal. So what you end up doing is cutting away the kind of vertical and horizontal ear canal, and you take it off the cartilage of the pinna, dissect it down to the tympanic bulla, and then section the ear canal, so you're left with the tube of the vertical and horizontal ear canal. So you take the whole thing out, rather than like with the vertical ear canal, you just remove the vertical portion and leave the horizontal ear canal left. So yeah, you remove the whole canal, and then I guess, yeah, you progress to doing a lateral bulbar osteotomy when you get to that point.
Yeah, so okay, so you're removing the painful disease part of the ear.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a salvage procedure. And then back to your question about the bulbar osteotomy, well, as we touched upon, many of these dogs will have significant otitis media. We need to treat that as well. So by doing a lateral bulbar osteotomy, it enables us to open up the middle ear and clean it out. So the bulbar osteotomy is to provide access, and then we're going to clean out and flush out the middle ear, essentially to ensure that no significant infection is left behind. Because the consequence of not doing that and leaving some infection behind is that the animals are likely to develop an abscess in that region, which will then require further potentially surgical treatment. So we'd always combine a lateral bulbar osteotomy with a total ear canal ablation, or the other way around, rather. You know, occasionally, if you're perhaps you're doing a, we didn't talk about other, you did ask me, but I didn't mention other reasons for TICA, and potentially severe ear canal trauma could be another reason, or a mass lesion. And, you know, in those dogs, you may think, well, actually, maybe they don't have any change in their middle ear. We'd still need to clean out the middle ear, because even, you know, a low grade and, you know, a bit of glom or something stuck in there could cause a problem in the future. So, but perhaps we need to be less, you know, if there's not significant otitis media, then it's likely that our bulbar osteotomy will be less intense.
Mm-hmm.
Less, yeah.
Definitely. Cool. And with these patients, when we see them as surgeons, do we prefer them to have a CT before surgery, or is it not necessary, or what kind of cases would you think that would be relevant for?
It's a great question. You know, obviously, I started doing total ear canal ablation before we had regular access to CT, so it wasn't really an option. We would routinely radiograph those animals. I suppose CT is useful if we're trying to make decisions based on, does the animal need surgery? So actually using the CT to document significant otitis media, or actually, you know, rule out significant middle ear involvement is potentially useful to help decide what to do. Potentially some animals can have quite marked changes in their bulla, so actually knowing about that prior to surgery might be helpful, particularly if you're less experienced with the technique. Very rarely we do see dogs with a strange thing called cholesteatoma, where they have a sort of a non-neoplastic keratin growth in their middle ear, which can actually distort the bulla quite significantly. And actually knowing about that before you do surgery is pretty helpful, because it does change the surgical picture a little bit. So CT is always, you know, useful in providing you with a bit more information, but most of the time it's not essential. I suppose if we had an animal with a neoplasm, then, you know, we're uncertain of the extent of it or the margins, then that's very useful. And particularly also we could combine it with, you know, thoracic imaging for staging purposes as well.
Yeah, for sure. So you touched on there the cholesteatomas. What would you tend to talk to owners about differently if you had a patient that you were suspecting had a cholesteatoma compared to one that had, say, chronic otitis externa or something?
Well, I think cholesteatoma is a bit of a funny deal. They're often associated with otitis externa and media. The main problem with cholesteatoma is that they're quite hard to get rid of. So there's a high rate of recurrence with these animals. So textbooks sort of predict something like 50% recurrence of potentially otitis media signs. So that's the big difference. So most of the time with total ear canal ablation, we're hoping to get quite a good outcome for the animal, and hopefully resolve their problem. But cholesteatoma, that becomes perhaps less guaranteed, which is obviously something the client needs to be aware of. And I suppose that brings us on to talking about complications, doesn't it? Because I think sometimes clients are very worried about the implications of TICA or ear surgery for their pet, and there's seemingly lots of alarming things on the internet that owners seem to get hold of. So I suppose it's worth just thinking about that and put that into context. So what are the main complications that we worry about with total ear canal ablation and bulbar osteotomy?
So if I was speaking to an owner, I'd often warn them about normal surgery complications such as bleeding and swelling and infection. I think from a surgical standpoint, we don't tend to see a heap of that. Sometimes you get a bit of seroma formation after the surgery. There is potential for fairly large bleeds during the surgery, So from the retroauricular, from the retroglenoid vein, and also underneath the bulla. If you're a bit overzealous with your bulla osteotomy, you can cause damage to the carotid, which can bleed quite a bit.
Have you done that?
No, I've seen it happen.
Okay.
Not when I've been operating. It's not that common, but I guess there is the potential for fairly large hemorrhage. I guess the ones that I'd mainly warn owners about and the ones that they'd potentially be worried about in the post-operative period, because they can be quite stark, are neurological complications. So obviously there's a facial nerve which tracks around the junction of the vertical and horizontal ear canal. So it goes from cortical to cranial around the base of the ear canal. So you have to be careful with that. You can potentially stretch that, which could cause temporary facial nerve paresis, or if you do a mischief on it, you could section it and it could cause permanent facial nerve paralysis. So I'd always warn owners with regards to facial nerve injury, but then also inside the bulla, you've got the vestibular apparatus.
Well, I think it's important to say that I think the incidence of permanent facial nerve dysfunction is pretty low.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, I'd always make sure that they're aware that it could potentially happen. And if it does happen, same with, you know, vestibular signs, they tend to be temporary and they tend to resolve on their own accord within kind of 6 weeks or so after surgery. If they don't, then they probably are more likely to be a permanent fixture for that patient. But if that's the case, dogs tend to cope with that relatively well anyway. So yeah, vestibular signs are another one, so they can get head tilt and nystagmus and kind of wobbliness. And sometimes patients will have Horner's as well post-surgery. Complication-wise, as Mickey touched on then, it's pretty infrequent that I can't think of any that have had permanent changes that we've done surgery on recently. But a lot of the time, because I think we're a little bit more overzealous with cleaning out the bulla, some of our patients will have mild neurological signs for 24, 48 hours after the surgery. But yeah, as I say, they don't tend to be long-term or permanent. Cats tend to be at slightly increased risk.
There's kind of a tension, isn't there, between making sure you clean out adequately and not damaging anything.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's always a bit of a tightrope to walk. But I think sometimes some dogs seem to be more vulnerable to damage than others, which is so. I think it's just a question of being careful. And
I think the concern is as well, I think since working with Farrell, I'm probably a little bit more thorough with cleaning out of the bulla than I was when I was working in practice. So I think that potentially I'm more likely to maybe incur minor neurological changes immediately post-op. But I'm happier that I've cleaned out more of the bulla, which makes it less likely that you'll develop a paraoral abscess later down the line, in theory.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's kind of how my style has slightly changed a little bit with doing this procedure. As I was going to touch on a minute ago, cats are at slightly increased risk of having these clinical signs, the neurological clinical signs post-surgery, than dogs are, so Horner's or vestibular signs. So I guess that's something I'd bear in mind if a cat was to have a Tika and LBO. So yeah, I guess cats are slightly different. Is there anything that you would approach, would you approach the situation slightly differently if you were doing a Tika on a cat compared to a dog?
Not quite sure what you're driving at there, Dan. It feels like I was going to ask you a question about that. But I think, well, do we do many Tikas in cats?
No, I've probably done a couple.
Well, why is that then?
So don't tend to have too many issues. And the middle ear issues they have tend to be related to inflammatory polyps. So we tend to do...
Yeah, so I suppose this is the key difference between dogs and cats, is that dogs could primarily have otitis externa, potentially leading to otitis media. Whereas cats don't really have a very high rate of significant otitis externa. So most of the time they have a primary problem with their middle ear.
Yeah.
And as Dan said, often that's, in young cats particularly, that was related to a nasopharyngeal polyp or auditory polyp. And but that's cats, older, particularly older cats, may get some primary otitis media as well. So essentially we're not necessarily, we don't have a end stage ear canal in cats most of the time. So we were going to treat those animals a bit differently. We do occasionally see a cat with a very bad ear, but I suppose when I'm doing Tikas, it's often in cats that have neoplasia or have had significant ear canal trauma. Actually, you know, to remove the ear canal in a cat is quite nice, because cats generally are much nicer to operate on than dogs. But the anatomy of the middle ear in particular is very different in cats. So we have to bear that in mind whenever we're doing middle ear surgery. So the key thing is that cats, as I'm sure you're all aware from your reading and anatomy and so forth, is that they have a double chambered bulla, with a, we've got to have to think carefully about this, a dorsolateral chamber and a ventromedial chamber. And so when we're doing a lateral bull osteotomy, we can get into the dorsomedial chamber, but we then also need to make sure that we enter the medial chamber as well in order to, you know, clear out both chambers adequately. There's a recent paper that we were reading about the other day that suggested that it's not always that easy to get into the second chamber, or perhaps be aware that whether you've done it or not, which is slightly confusing. So TEEK is far less commonly performed in cats, but you know, sometimes we do it. They are, as Dan said, at slightly greater risk of certain complications. But most of the time when we're going to be operating on cats' ears, we're going to be doing a different approach. So we're primarily interested in treating the middle ear. So most of the time we're going to access that via ventral bull osteotomy. So a ventral approach to the middle ear. And which is quite a neat little surgery in cats. But again, when we're doing that, we need to make sure that we enter both chambers. And then the complications associated with that procedure are primarily related to nerve damage, potentially the sympathetic nerves, which can cause Horner syndrome. But very unlikely to get facial nerve paralysis with the ventral approach. But we can also see vestibular signs as well.
Are there other ways that you can potentially treat inflammatory polyps in cats, or other things that people do?
Yes, I think there are descriptions of doing traction of polyps, potentially giving the cat steroids. So we don't really know why cats get these inflammatory polyps. They can be in the sort of nasopharynx, or they can lie in the ear. So traction works really, really well for the nasopharyngeal polyps. Pull them out, and often that's essentially curative, I think something like 90%, whereas only about 50% will be fixed with traction on the ear polyps. And I think that's often related to the fact they've got secondary otitis media, and I mean, you kind of need to address that. If I will treat these cats, I will pull the polyp out because it's sort of part of the before surgery, and then do the ventral bull osteotomy to clean out the remaining muck from the middle ear. Mm-hmm. And that seems to work quite well.
Cool. I guess we're getting towards the end of our time now, but I've got one final question. It's more of a personal preference question or a personal thought question. So when you're doing a TEEK, what do you think is the trickiest part of the procedure for you?
Well, I don't know. I haven't really thought about it. What's the tricky? What do you find the most tricky?
Well, I find knowing when to stop debriding the bulla is the trickiest part of the procedure, because as we touched on earlier, it's a delicate balance between being careful not to cause any damage to the vestibular apparatus or the nervous structures in the ear, so the sympathetic nerves, versus making sure you get as much of the epithelial lining out. And I don't think we get as much epithelial lining out as we think we do. There was that recent study, wasn't there, where they put a 1-9 rigid scope inside tympanic bullets after they've been derided, and they found that they left quite a large proportion of epithelium. This was in normal patients, though. They left quite a large proportion of epithelium, particularly rostrally. But what is the significance of that? Because clearly we don't get it all, but is there a critical mass that we need to get in order to prevent them from developing paraoral abscesses? Or so I find that trade-off of knowing that I've debrided enough, but not too much that I potentially cause damage.
It must be quite annoying when I come along and find more.
Yes, but, yeah. That is pretty frustrating. We should stop doing that.
So sorry. I've been doing TEEK for quite a long time. I quite like a TEEK. They don't get complacent. I think that's right. I mean, judging the amount of scraping to do, I suppose, is very important, as Dan says. And that probably is sort of an art to that, to some extent. So I guess to finish off, we talked a little bit about at the start about how this was a salvage procedure, and it's primarily around sort of improving quality of life. And, wouldn't it be interesting if we could find out how these dogs do in terms of their quality of life in the future?
That's a really good segue. Very interesting question. At the moment, we are running a study here. Looking at the quality of life in dogs with chronic otitis externa and also their owners before and after they have TEEK surgery. So the way that we're running it is we're gathering lots of data about these patients, and then we are giving the owners a questionnaire, an online questionnaire that takes about 5 minutes to fill out before the dog has surgery, and then following up with another one 2 months after the surgery. And we're using validated quality of life questionnaires for ear disease in dogs and owners. So we're quite fortunate to have access to a questionnaire that's already been made, which is great. So yeah, we're doing that. We're running the study at the moment and we're recruiting cases. So if you've got any patients with chronic otitis externa that need a TICA, then obviously send them our way. It would be super helpful to
Please. Get
a bit more information about it. So yeah, I'd be very, very thankful if you have any for it.
I think that's really interesting, isn't it? Because kind of it's a big deal for some of these owners and it does affect their quality of life, particularly if they have to medicate their dog regularly and it's a big struggle.
For sure.
But I think, you know, we focus on improving the quality of life of the dogs, but I think that we also by default will improve the owner's quality of life, so it'd be nice to demonstrate that more conclusively,
because we'd often recommend the surgery for that purpose, won't we, to improve the patient's quality of life. But there's not a great deal that there's nothing really in the literature to suggest that that actually is the case at this point in time, so we're trying to kind of definitively nail that down. But as Mickey says, it's very interesting to see how this affects the owners too, because if you think about it, it is a pretty big commitment for owners to put, you know, ear medications down their dog's ear, especially if the dog's kind of protesting. It does affect their relationship with the dog, which is, it can make people pretty sad. So it's interesting just to see how the viewpoints change before and after surgery. So yeah.
Well, I look forward to hearing what you find out with that. That's really exciting. Well, I think that's probably enough for today. But thank you very much for your participation and your questions, Dan. I think that was really good. And thank you very much, everyone, for listening. I hope it's been useful. If you do have any further questions, then do feel free to get in touch and we'll be happy to talk about them some more. Thank you.
Bye-bye.